Before I get started on my discussion of fire blight resistance and susceptibility loci, I first want to acknowledge my collaborators, specifically Jane Arelli, as well as the WSU Apple Breeding Program team and multiple funding sources that made this work possible. So fire blight is a potentially devastating bacterial disease in apple that causes structural damage and potentially tree death. And the problem with fire blight is that most commercial apple varieties and cultivars are susceptible to highly susceptible. There's a gradient of susceptibility, but most are susceptible to some extent. And current control methods, specifically thinking about antibiotics, are unsustainable, costly, and only partially effective. Now, breeding for resistance offers a potential long-term solution, but it has its challenges. Most sources of resistance up to this point have been characterized in wild genetic backgrounds with relatively poor fruit quality, which makes introgression relatively challenging. Most resistance is quantitative in nature, so any given locus is not giving complete resistance. And phenotyping is challenging. Disease severity and incidence are strongly influenced by environmental factors as well as host factors. And then apple itself is not the easiest to work with its long generation time, self-incompatibility, and high heterozygosity. So as continuing the trend with the previous two talks, DNA information has increased the efficiency of breeding in apples. Specifically, it's involved with increased efficiency, if you think about pre-selection, potential cost savings, and then when thinking about breeding for resistance, it's a more efficient way of pyramiding multiple resistance alleles at multiple potential loci. And fundamentally, using DNA information boils down to a more precise choice earlier on in the breeding process. But in order for us to be able to utilize DNA-informed breeding for fire blight resistance, we first have to identify loci associated with fire blight resistance and susceptibility in germplasm that's breeding relevant. So most QTL studies for fire blight resistance and susceptibility up to this point have been done in biparental families that are not necessarily representative or relevant to breeding germplasm. But luckily, as part of the Rosebreed project, a pedigree-connected germplasm reference set was developed that consists of small pedigree-connected full sieve families that are representative of important breeding parents, in the three major U.S. public apple scion breeding programs, so Cornell University, University of Minnesota, and Washington State University. Now, the original focus of this germplasm set was on fruit quality traits. So there's segregation in these full sieve families for traits like soluble solid content, malic acid, etc. But lucky for us, there's also segregation for fire blight resistance and susceptibility. In addition, all of these individuals have been genotyped using the AK SNP array. So we have segregation for fire blight resistance and susceptibility, and we have genotypic information. So the goal of this study was to leverage those resources and to detect loci associated with fire blight resistance and susceptibility in this pedigree-connected germplasm set that's representative of important breeding parents in these breeding programs. So again, the germplasm that we're working with is this Rosebreed pedigree-connected apple crop reference set. It contains 94 cultivars and important breeding parents. I'm not going to discuss those today, but know that they're there, and it was published earlier this year, the phenotypic data. And then the 314 seedlings represent 27 important breeding parents. Important breeding parents in these programs include individuals like Cripps Pink, Honeycrisp, Enterprise, Aurora Golden Gala, Splendor, etc., Golden Delicious. Honeycrisp is a very important cultivar, and it's a very important breeding parent, and it's highly represented in this germplasm set with 112 half-sib seedlings. Those 314 seedlings are in 32 full-sib families with an average full-sib family size of 10 seedlings. So right off the top of the bat, that looks like a very small full-sib family size, but you have to keep in mind that these are all pedigree-connected. So those pedigree connections increase our statistical power and broaden our representation, allowing us to detect potential loci. And again, all those individuals were genotyped using the 8K SNP array. Phenotypic data was gathered through a two-year replicated field inoculation trial. So all individuals were propagated on M111 rootstock. The reason I mention this rootstock is because it produces freestanding semi-vigorous trees, and vigor plays an important role in fire blight susceptibility. There were three trees per individual planted in a randomized complete block design. This panoramic image is of us inoculating in 2017, and it just gives you an idea of the scale of this field experiment. Inoculation took place in 2016 and then was repeated on the same trees in 2017. We inoculated 3 to 10 actively growing shoots per tree, so there were up to 30 shoots per individual per year inoculated, utilizing the cut leaf method, which is as simple as it sounds. You dip scissors into an inoculum suspension, clip the tip of the shoot above the meristem to create a wound that allows for bacterial entry. We waited 6 weeks before we measured response, and at the time of measurement, for each inoculated shoot, we measured the total shoot length within the current season's growth, and then the lesion length within the current season's growth. So from those measurements, I calculated a proportion of shoot length that was blighted, with a higher proportion indicating a more susceptible response. Now, fire blight is an inherently variable disease, strongly influenced by environment, and we also took repeated measures per tree. So to account for some of that environmental noise, as well as the repeated measures, I used a mixed linear model to estimate best linear unbiased predictions for that SLB data. And basically, you can think of that as regressing towards the mean so that we can get a more sound estimate of seedling susceptibility. Those BLUP values were adjusted with the overall trait mean so that it was on a scale of 0 to 1 as opposed to negative 0.5 to 0.5, and that's just easier to interpret that type of scale. And these were used as phenotypic values in our QTL analyses. I utilized Flex QTL software for pedigree-informed QTL analyses, and this software allows us to account for those pedigree connections. Now, it utilizes a Bayesian approach, so we have to do multiple statistical runs to ensure that we're getting consistent results. So I did 2 runs per phenotypic data set. There are 3 phenotypic data sets. We have the 2016 average SLB BLUP data set, 2017, and then an across year. You can think of it across year average. Okay, so this is the phenotypic data. On the x-axis, we have the 2016 average SLB BLUP values. So from left to right, we have increasing susceptibility. On the y-axis, we have the 2017 average SLB BLUP values. So from bottom to top, increasing susceptibility. And then you have the marginal histograms. And so what I want you to take 2 things away from this plot. First of all, we have a wide range in response to fire blight, from ranging from highly resistant to highly susceptible. We also have strong repeatability between both years, indicating that we should be able to pick up similar loci from year to year with this repeatability. So in the next couple slides, I'm going to be walking through some of the QTL analyses results. I'm only going to show you a single run per phenotypic data set, but know that they were repeatable across runs. Okay, so this is for the 2016 average SLB BLUP data set. So on the x-axis, we have chromosome for a subset of apples' chromosomes. On the y-axis, we have posterior intensity. We can think of this as a probability value. A higher intensity indicates a higher probability. And then I have basically a rough statistical threshold there for your benefit. And then the percentage values above each of those chromosomes are the percent variance explained by a given putative locus. So what we can see here is that we have putative loci on chromosomes 6, 7, 8, 15, and 16, accounting anywhere from 7 to about 14% of the variation, which makes sense. This is a very quantitative trait, so that's about where we would expect it to be, combined accounting for about 54% of the phenotypic variation. But this is only for the 2016 data set. What does the 2017 look like? Okay, same plot, just different data set. So chromosome on the x-axis, posterior intensity on the y. Again, we're seeing putative loci on chromosome 6, 7, 8, and 15, but that locus on 16 has disappeared. So it could have been an artifact of the 2016 data set, or it could be a strongly environmentally dependent locus. So whatever was happening in 2016, it didn't pop up in 2017. So again, these are accounting for about 7 to 13% of the phenotypic variance, and combined about 39% because, again, we lost that 2016 locus. But in order for us to determine what locus or set of loci we want to target for DNA test development, we want to make sure that they're repeatable not only in the percent variance that they're explaining but also in the location. So in this next slide, we're looking at repeatability. So the same plots. On the top, we have the 2016. In the middle, we have 2017. And on the bottom, we have the combined data sets. And so what you can take away here is that we have a consistent locus on chromosome 6, consistent loci on chromosome 7 and 15. We have a peak in all of our data sets on chromosome 8, but you can see that it shifts. In 2017, it shifts upwards, and then in the 2016 and 2017 data sets, just really a big, broad peak. This could be due to the fact that there are multiple QTLs here, or there's something else going on. So we need to take a closer look later on with chromosome 8. As you're all well aware, identification of loci really is only the first step towards DNA test development. So there are multiple steps that we have to go through in the next year for me to make sure that we can start to develop a DNA test. And one of the questions that I first want to answer is, do these loci that I've detected co-localize with previously identified loci? So previous biparental studies have identified loci in chromosome 6, 7, 8, 15, and then potentially 16. So are these the same or are they different? We want to compare resistant versus susceptible individuals and look at their haplotypes within those regions to determine what haplotypes are associating with resistance and susceptibility, because those are what we want to target potentially for marker-assisted selection. And then are there resistance, potential putative resistance genes within these regions? They're pretty big regions, so there's probably quite a bit that's going on within those. And fundamentally, you remember that we're developing DNA tests for breeding use, so we want to be able to characterize our germplasm, select better breeding parents, and select against fire blight susceptible seedlings. But before I end, I want to take a step back and really just think about the implications of this work as we move forward. So I've identified putative loci on chromosome 6, 7, 8, 15, and potentially 16, but these will enable the development of DNA-based tests that apple breeders can utilize to more efficiently select better breeding parents, select against fire blight susceptible seedlings, more efficiently pyramid multiple resistance alleles for more durable fire blight resistance, and most importantly, efficiently combine high fruit quality, which is the whole point of an apple, with fire blight resistance. And this funnels down into a much more long-term implication, which is the development of new improved apple cultivars with more durable resistance to fire blight for a more sustainable apple industry. With that, I would like to thank you all for your attention this morning, and I will take any questions. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
So was there a correlation between the number of resistance alleles and field survey for resistance?
So the question was, is there a correlation between the number of resistance alleles and the number? So we're just starting to look into haplotypes, and so there are multiple potential resistance alleles floating around because we have so many potential parents represented, but there are varying effects. So what we define as a resistance allele is really, from a pathology standpoint, is really reduced susceptibility, but there is a correlation, yeah. Yeah, Heidi.
So at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that you selected a specific root stock.
Yes. So the question is, basically, is there a rootstock effect on resistance? And so the short answer is yes, there is going to be a rootstock effect. And so you're going to want to test potential resistant individuals on other rootstocks. But the susceptible individuals are going to be really susceptible. And since it was a really vigorous rootstock, we really pushed these hard, and we had high rates of susceptibility in our susceptible controls. Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, do the alleles that are potentially segregating in this germplasm set apply to other species in the rosaceae, in the genera? Okay. The short answer is I don't know. It could potentially, but that would be a question that we would want to answer. The big question is, would it potentially apply to pear? Maybe, but who knows? Yeah. Yeah. Have we identified candidate genes? That would be the next step, but I have not gone that way yet. Yeah. Yeah.
So